The thrill of victory, the agony of living with a bad reputation, Saudi Arabia's wide world of sports.
You know, right now, Saudi Arabia has come with a big bag of money and is looking for economic and geopolitical opportunities. No sport is out of bounds right now.
Also today, Russia's army for hire is desperate for soldiers. They're posting recruitment videos with a pretty low bar for entry.
At this point, they need to hire as many people as possible. They're trying to hire anyone who is able to hold a gun.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, for motorcycle riders who are turban-wearing six, safety first simply does not work.
We like to ride the bike, and problem is here, we can't put on helmets.
So in California, they're pushing for a religious exemption. All that and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us. In Ukraine, relief efforts are underway for people evacuated from floods after a major dam was breached on the Dnipro River. We'll be turning to that just ahead. First, though, to Saudi Arabia. Today in Jeddah, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. According to the State Department, the two men affirmed a, quote, shared commitment to advance stability, security, and prosperity across the Middle East and beyond, end quote. Kind of dry diplo speak. What's not so dry?
Let's get to that shocking merger that has shaken up the world of golf. PGA Tour and the Saudi-backed LIV Golf agreeing to merge, putting aside their bitter rivalry that had divided top players, golf fans, and corporate sponsors.
CNBC there with the news that shocked the world of golf yesterday. Today, we're looking at that as well as Saudi Arabia's enormous investments in sports well beyond golf. Simon Chadwick follows this closely. He teaches about sports and the global economy at the Schema Business School in Paris. First of all, Simon, this merger between the PGA and LIV, as it's known, LIV basically bankrolled through Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, the monarchy. Is it clear yet whether that is indeed a merger, or has Saudi Arabia just become the de facto owner of professional golf?
That as yet remains to be determined. I think this is going to play out now over the next year or two. And we're certainly going to see, I think, Saudi Arabia exerting its interests and flexing its financial and political muscles through golf. Although the spin tends to suggest it's a partnership of equals, I rather think that that's not the case. And there is an asymmetry of power. And what we'll find in maybe 5 years' time is that the power most definitely is in the hands of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia has also invested heavily in soccer as well recently. Tell us the significance of what they've done.
Most notably is the signing of Cristiano Ronaldo by Al Nassr, which is a Saudi Pro League club. We're also seeing several other players going there. So that just this week, Karim Benzema, who was the FIFA World Player of the Year last year, has moved to Al Ittihad in Jeddah. We're also hearing rumors, too, of, for example, Saudi Arabia making a joint bid for the 2030 Men's FIFA World Cup, possibly in conjunction with Egypt and Greece as well. So we're talking about a country that is spending billions of dollars in pursuing a national vision in which sport has a fundamental part to play.
What other sports does Saudi Arabia have its eyes on?
So right now, you know, pretty much everything, I think, is a simple way to put that.
Wow.
So we know in motorsport, for example, in Formula One, in Formula E, in rallying, in boxing, mixed martial arts, WWE. There are even stories right now that Saudi Arabia is looking to invest in cricket. You know, right now, Saudi Arabia has come with a big bag of money and is looking for economic and geopolitical opportunities, hence the golf deal. But I think no sport is out of bounds right now. And there are even stories that maybe the Saudi Arabia is looking to acquire an NBA franchise, which obviously would be truly shocking to a lot of people in the United States.
NBA, wow, that would be incredible. Officially, Simon, what does Saudi Arabia say are its reasons for investing so heavily in sports?
Number one is they're trying to diversify their economy, an economy hugely dependent upon oil and gas revenues in a world that is kicking back against carbon fuels. Saudi Arabia has big public health problems, high rates of hypertension, diabetes, strokes, heart attack. One of the reasons for that is a largely physically inactive population. So sport is a great way to engage people as a public health intervention. There are issues around image and reputation management. We know that Saudi Arabia is not well perceived in certain parts of the world, and sport can help to change attitudes and perceptions.
So the question is Saudi Arabia actually changing its behavior regarding human rights, or are they presenting sports as a distraction for the rest of the world?
I don't think Saudi Arabia is principally or primarily presenting sports as a distraction. I genuinely do think that for the government in Saudi Arabia, sport is front and center stage in a national development strategy, very often informed by highly paid Manhattan consultants, by the way, that is intended to move the country forward into its post-oil and gas future in a way that addresses the needs and wants of Generation Z consumers. But at the same time, I think there is a political context to all of this. And what we are seeing, I think, is a pivot from global north to countries in the global south, like Saudi Arabia, economically and politically exerting their power and control and influence over professional sport, influence where competitions are staged. You're beginning to influence what athletes can and can't say. And a lot of the certainties that those of us in what we historically would call the West, we're increasingly having to change our view of what it means to be engaged in sport.
Simon Chadwick is a professor of sports and the global economy at the Schema Business School in Paris. Really interesting stuff, Simon. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now to Ukraine and the latest on that catastrophic dam breach along the Dnipro River. Engineering experts believe it was likely caused by a deliberate attack from inside the Kakhovka Dam. Both Russia and Ukraine continue to point the finger at each other. Meanwhile, downstream from the dam, thousands of people have evacuated flooded towns and neighborhoods. Sevalod Prokofiev is a spokesperson for Save the Children, which has been working in the flood-affected areas. Sevalod, describe the situation where you're at. What have you seen?
Marco, the situation with this catastrophic flood has been pretty unpredictable because we still see the water arriving, and it is now arriving in the town of Mykolaiv, which is 100 kilometers away from the now destroyed dam. And we see more and more households getting flooded across Kherson region and in Kherson itself. According to latest reports by the local authorities, we now have around 1,800 households flooded in Kherson alone, and about the same number of people, 1,800 people evacuated from these areas, including more than 100 children.
What kinds of accounts, Sevalod, have you heard from evacuees and what they're going through?
People, they were extremely alarmed. They woke up early in the morning. Some of them were notified, like alarmed by their neighbors. Many of them picked just very few belongings, some basic clothes, some documents, and fled to the neighboring villages because they have relatives there or they just want to have a shelter. They are too afraid of floods. I talked to one woman, Inga, who took her elderly grandmother with her, who barely can walk. She uses crutches to move around. So they had to flee with barely anything. So we are providing these families, as long with other displaced families, cash assistance to be able to cover for basic needs in the nearest future, because this is what people are really hoping for, to be able to return to their homes.
And what have officials told you about the long-term impacts? When can residents expect to be able to return to their homes? Or are some homes so damaged many residents just won't return?
We will not know the exact extent of damages done unless the water goes. It's been reported, estimated that the water will go in about a week or so, and only then we will know how many families, how many households will require help with repairs, how many of them cannot return and will be displaced in more long-term perspective. But there are some sort of more alarming risks about this situation, because this Kakhovka reservoir is supplying water not only to the neighborhood of Kherson city, but also to every basically small and major town sources its water from this reservoir. What's been prioritized by the local authorities in Kherson region is that we distribute clean water. It's been rumored that around 500,000 liters are required for those affected areas, because clean and drinking water is basically down, so the pumps cannot work properly, and this is affecting population as well. They do not have proper water sewage, and people there live on water from wells, which are currently being flooded as well. So basically no clean drinking water. Those areas, they've been areas of active hostilities. They were displaced, they fled active combat, they returned to their homes, but now they have to flee them again. So this is a terrible mental burden on them as well. But once again, we are here to help. We are also about to launch some sort of mine risk awareness campaigns across the region so people are notified about that danger as well.
The landmines, you're saying, yeah.
Landmines and unexploded ordnance because, yeah, the water torrents are bringing everything up.
Cefalod Prokofiev is a spokesperson for Save the Children, which has been working in the city of Mykolaiv, Ukraine, where relief efforts are being staged to help with flooding on the Dnipro River. Thank you very much, and good luck.
Yeah, thanks to you as well. Have a nice one.
In recent weeks, there have been new signs that the Taliban want an end to their isolation from the international community. Last week, for example, Reuters reported about a secret meeting that took place between the group's supreme leader and Qatar's prime minister. This is significant because the supreme leader has always been a shadowy, reclusive figure. The world's Shirin Jafari is here to tell us more. What do we know about this meeting, Shirin?
This was a meeting between Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al-Thani, Qatar's prime minister, and Haybatullah Akhundzada, who is currently the supreme leader of the Taliban. And it took place in a city called Kandahar, that's in southern Afghanistan. And as far as we know, this is the first time that the supreme leader has met with a foreign official. This meeting reportedly took place last month, and there was a range of topics that the two men discussed, including women's education and employment in Afghanistan. As you know, Marco, and as we have reported on the show, the Taliban, since they came to power in 2021, have banned women from working in most jobs, and they have prohibited girls from getting an education beyond the sixth grade.
And what about the timing of this meeting, Shirin? Why has the supreme leader of the Taliban decided to break away from his usual reclusive life and meet with the prime minister of Qatar?
So since 2021, no country has officially recognized the Taliban's government. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that some officials within the group are still on international sanctions list. Another reason is because some of the policies that the group have implemented are really controversial. And so countries want to see these lifted before they can proceed with an official recognition. And they also want to see a dialogue between different factions within Afghanistan for a more inclusive government. So far, none of that has materialized.
And why is the small Gulf state of Qatar involved here? What's the government's role?
Qatar, as you say, is not a neighbor of Afghanistan. It's a country in the Persian Gulf. But it has been involved diplomatically behind the scenes, mediating with the Taliban for more than a decade now. The Taliban had an office there when they were fighting against the Afghan government, and Taliban officials have even lived there. This is something that I asked Omar Samad about. He's a former Afghan diplomat. Here's some of what he had to say.
Let's not forget the Qataris also represent U.S. interests in Afghanistan. This meeting that took place with the Qatari prime minister, we hope, will have given the Qataris and the international community, through the Qataris, the opportunity to impress upon the Taliban leadership the importance of girls' education.
And he says not only education, Marco, but also women's employment. So this was a rare and important opportunity here.
Yes, yeah, so what is the bottom line here, Shirin? Are there signs that the Taliban leader is actually prepared to respond to this international pressure about girls' education and employment?
It's definitely significant that the top leadership of the Taliban is hearing these concerns in person. But we have to add here that the bans on Afghan girls going to school and women working outside their homes remain in place. At the end of the day, the Taliban need international recognition. The economy of Afghanistan is in a dire state. The UN says that nearly three quarters of the country's population need help to survive. This is a reality that the Taliban cannot ignore.
The world's Shirin Jafari with an update on the Taliban's moves at ending their international isolation. Shirin, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you've seen any photos of New York City today, it's pretty surreal. A red sunrise and a city clouded in haze. and what you can't see, the smell of a campfire. That's the way a lot of the Northeast feels today. The smoke has drifted down from Canada, where wildfires have forced thousands of people to flee their homes. Scott Tingley heads the Wildfire Management Group at Nova Scotia's Department of Natural Resources and Renewables. He's in Shubenacadie. Scott, what is the current situation with these wildfires up there in Nova Scotia?
We currently have 5 active wildfires in our province. We're having a historic season. You know, one fire we're calling the Barrington Fire. It's 23,000 plus hectares at this point, and it's considered being held. All the other 4 fires are under control. But that one large fire is the largest fire we've had in recorded history. And we've fortunately had some significant rainfall through the weekend and the early part of the week here. So that's really helped us out, helping ground crews and in helicopters and heavy equipment start to make some gains on these large wildfires.
Yeah, well, that's good news, the rain. What about people and property? What kind of damage has this caused?
This has been hugely impactful here in Nova Scotia. We've had over 200 homes between the two instances. So we had another fire up in Tantallon area, just outside of Halifax, one of our major cities. The neighborhood in Tantallon, there was about a 1,000 hectare fire. And, you know, up in there, there's 150 homes with additional outbuildings that have burned in that area. And down in the Shelburne County fire, the very, very large fire, we've got an additional 60 plus homes, plus more outbuildings and cottages. So it's been devastating. We're still focused on suppression and extinguishing these fires, but, you know, we still have folks that are still under evacuation orders and have not been able to return to their homes. Once we put these fires out, it's supporting these folks and the long road ahead to rebuilding these communities.
In Boston and New York and the Northeast, there are air quality alerts. How are these fires in Canada impacting air and health quality there?
We had some air quality alerts in Nova Scotia here for sure. While the large fires were very active, it's kind of just depended on the weather pattern. The state of the country at this point, you know, we've also got large fires now in parts of Quebec, Ontario, into the prairies in Western Canada. So there's a lot of large fire activity across the country, and probably is where a lot of that smoke that you're seeing now into the U.S. is coming from.
Right. Well, as you said, there are wildfires to your west and in Quebec, all across Canada. Is there a network across the country of wildfire management experts? I mean, how does this all work?
Yeah. So I'm calling in here today from our provincial wildfire coordination center. So each agency would have a provincial coordination center, and we're all interconnected through the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center. And it's made up of all the member agencies, so all the provinces, territories, and Parks Canada agency. And we have a mutual aid agreement that allows us to move personnel, aircraft, and equipment very efficiently when one area needs help. Unfortunately, right now, we're experiencing a period where multiple parts of the country are busy. And so the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center has actually reached out quite broadly internationally to bring in additional resources as well. You know, Nova Scotia is also part of another mutual aid agreement, the Northeast Forest Fire Protection Commission. And we actually have a crew made up of members from New York, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Maine. So that fire crew came up last Saturday, and we really thank them for being able to come up and help us out when we were in our time of need.
Mm. Scott, it's not even summer yet, and the number of fires, as you pointed out, is already discouraging. What are you expecting in terms of wildfires as temperatures climb and the weeks go on?
Yeah, so it's been a busy start. Fortunately, with this rain for us here in Nova Scotia, this is going to buy us some time. We have large fires that still need to be extinguished, so we're focused on getting that done as quickly and safely as we can. We've got a bit of time before the wildfire risk increases here in Nova Scotia, but there's lots of summer left, and so we need to be prepared. So we want to get these fires out, get everything back on the shelf, and get ready again for what could be the rest of the summer.
Do you feel adequately equipped to keep things under control if more rain does not come?
At this stage, yeah. We're adequately prepared for anything that is going to come up given the current weather. And if we end up in a situation later in the summer where we've got large fires again and it gets beyond what we can do internally, then we know we can reach out through our mutual aid partners to get additional resources.
Scott Tingley heads the Wildfire Management Group at Nova Scotia's Department of Natural Resources and Renewables. Scott, thank you very much and good luck with the job at hand.
Yeah, thanks, Marco. Thanks for reaching out. We appreciate it.
Helmets are widely cited as life-saving headwear, especially for motorcyclists. In many parts of the world, laws require all bikers to wear them. That includes California. There's one religious community, though, that's looking for an exemption to the state's helmet mandate. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Mandeep Singh is a business person and social worker in Selma, California. In his free time, he likes to hop on his motorcycle and enjoys riding it with fellow Sikhs.
We like to ride the bike. And problem is here, we can't put on helmets.
They can't put on helmets because of their turbans, which they don't remove or cover up for religious reasons. Singh says turbans have a deep meaning behind them and are more than head coverings.
When we tying this turban, we remember we have to work hard, we have to pray to God, and we have to share with others, those who are in need.
Singh was speaking at a California Senate committee hearing in support of proposed legislation. It would exempt people who wear religious or cultural headdresses from wearing helmets when riding a motorcycle in the state. Senator Brian Dahle introduced the bill earlier this year after hearing from members of the Sikh community. He says it's not the first of its kind in the states.
Our own U.S. military allows the wearing of turbans and paddocks instead of requiring head covers.
International precedent also exists. Several provinces in Canada allow Sikhs to ride motorcycles without helmets. Same with the UK and India, where the Sikh religion was founded and is primarily practiced today. But in 2019, a German court struck down similar legislation, citing safety reasons. And in Australia, Sikhs have been campaigning for a helmet exemption for years, so far with no luck. California's bill also has its fair share of opposition.
I will not be able to support this bill today.
Senator Scott Wiener urged lawmakers to be cautious at a hearing last week.
When someone has a head injury because of a motorcycle accident because they're not wearing a helmet, it affects them and their family and their children. It affects the entire community. It affects the healthcare system.
The County Health Executives Association of California and the Automobile Club of Southern California also oppose the bill. In an email, the Auto Club pointed out that helmets reduce the risk of head injuries from motorcycle crashes by 69% and deaths by 37%, according to the CDC. In a phone interview yesterday, Senator Dahle told me he understands the safety concerns, but says adults should be able to make their own choices.
The only person that's going to be impacted is them. And so for me, it's more about the freedoms and their customs than it is about safety.
One Canadian company is trying to achieve both goals with their prototype called Tough Turban.
Having an option to wear the Tough Turban is amazing. It's the best of both worlds. You've got the safety aspect of it. I'm actually very excited to see how they pulled this off.
A promotional video shows Sikh motorcyclists wearing what looks like a typical turban, but it's made of high-tech fabric and 3D-printed protective armor. The Tough Turban hasn't hit production yet, but anyone can download the designs online for free. I asked Senator Dahle if the product is something the Sikhs he represents would consider.
No, not really. But as legislation goes, sometimes there's give and take, so we haven't really went down that path.
The measure cleared the California State Senate last week. Senator Dahle says he will now amend the bill to address safety concerns and logistics before it goes through committee hearings in the Assembly. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Carbon offsets have long been considered a key way to fight climate change. Pollute here, plant trees there. Some say that's a recipe for disaster.
We need everything everywhere all at once, meaning, you know, it's not this type of action or that type of action. We need to be pushing on all of it and using every tool in the toolkit.
Keeping folks honest on their carbon offsets, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For months, we've been hearing talk of Ukraine's military launching a counteroffensive against Russian forces. Any forward push will be a slog. Russia has had time to dig in, preparing World War I-style trenches, but they need more troops to hold the line. More than 100,000 Russian fighters have been killed or wounded since December. That's according to estimates from Washington. Many were part of Russia's Army for Hire, known as the Wagner Group. A lot of them were recently released convicts. Now Wagner has intensified its campaign to appeal to just about anyone who can hold a gun. Dina Temple-Raston, host of the Click Here podcast, explains in this report that Wagner has taken a page from a group that had one of the most successful virtual recruiting operations the world has ever known, the Islamic State, or ISIS.
Ryan is 15 years old, a sophomore in high school, and he lives in Northern California. And we're only using his first name for reasons that will become clear in a moment. Sometimes, late at night, strange music comes from behind his bedroom door. Ryan is a bit of a musician. He plays the violin. And one night, as he was scrolling through YouTube videos, he heard this strange variation on a classical song he knew.
I said, I know exactly where this is from. This is just a verbatim copied from somebody else's music. The first few measures of the song, or not the main theme of the song, is stolen from Carl Jenkins, who wrote Palladio, which is where it was stolen from.
It had been transformed from a classical song to a head-banging heavy metal one. And it was done by a group that Ryan had recently become obsessed with, the Wagner Group, a private Russian army. And these days, it may be best known for committing war crimes in Ukraine. The group has been working behind the scenes for years to help Vladimir Putin extend his reach around the world. They're protecting local government officials in Mali. They're mining blood diamonds in the Central African Republic. And most recently, were front and center when the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut finally fell to Russian forces. And the more Ryan looked into Wagner after he heard that song, the more fascinated he became by them. Their online presence is massive and everywhere.
There's songs about Wagner that are playing on the radio in Donetsk and Luhansk. They're releasing rap videos. And they've actually made like propaganda films about Wagner. There's films about Wagner's training.
He discovered their crazy GoPro battle videos. This was a multimedia extravaganza aimed at convincing young recruits to come and join the fight. What Ryan didn't know at the time was that those tactics weren't something Wagner dreamed up. They swiped them from another militant group that about 10 years ago managed to lure tens of thousands of people to Syria to fight. And that group was the Islamic State, or ISIS. Not long after Ryan started his Wagner research project, he launched a blog to share what he was discovering. He called it Nordsund. And professional researchers actually started following it and commenting on it and adding to it. And the thing they all seemed to want to know was this: what compels people to join Wagner? And Ryan, in a way only a 15-year-old can, just decided to ask them. Of course, he couldn't say, "I'm an open source researcher in high school." They'd never respond. So instead, he started creating personas, people he thought might get Wagner's attention.
I would just directly contact them and say, "Hey, I am interested in joining Wagner. Here is my information."
He used ChatGPT to translate his messages into Russian.
I was posing as a 22-year-old recruit at the time. My father died. And my mother doesn't want me to go to Ukraine. That was the character I was using.
The first time you did that, how long before they got back to you? Was it right away?
It was like a few hours, yeah.
One of the group's recruiters in Russia began corresponding with him directly. He began asking Ryan questions about himself. Where did he live? What kind of fighting experience did he have? What were his long-term goals? You know, the standard job screening questions.
I mean, typically, you message them, you know, saying that you're interested in joining Wagner, and they will ask you to provide, you know, your documents. Maybe say, they ask you, have you served in the military? Which city do you live?
Just to be clear, his parents gave us permission to talk to him about his research. And in return, we promised not to use his last name to keep them safe.
The first time I did it, I was thinking, like, you know, there is no way that this is actually happening.
Some 9,000 of Wagner's troops are thought to have died in Ukraine already. So that means Wagner continuously needs more recruits. Just warm bodies, really. Not the best and the brightest, not the most ideologically aligned, just bodies. This, not so coincidentally, is exactly the position ISIS found itself in back in 2013, when it took over great swaths of Syria and Iraq and then proclaimed it an Islamic State. To suck people in, ISIS built a flashy recruitment campaign, and now Wagner has one too. Its leader is a man named Yevgeny Prigozhin, and he led Wagner's battle against ISIS in Syria. What's become clear now is that while he was fighting them, he was taking notes on how they recruited.
So Yevgeny Prigozhin is trying to promote Wagner as a brand.
And Ryan has seen telltale signs of that, not just online, but in the real world, too.
They opened recruitment centers in gyms, and it's just a table with one or two people sitting there with a Wagner flag on the desk saying, you know, we are recruiting for Wagner, you can come join us.
All of this marketing effort seemed to be paying off. The United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense and the Department of Defense in the U.S. estimate that Wagner has as many as 50,000 fighters in Ukraine. And a lot of what Ryan had been trying to understand in his research was why.
So what entices so many people to join Wagner? Is it the money or is it something else?
And the answer, in part, is that in their own way, Wagner targets a particular cohort, just like ISIS did. Young men down on their luck, isolated from society. ISIS preyed on young Muslim men. Wagner recruits in rural areas of Russia. It looks for people who have no jobs or no money, or people fresh out of prison. People like this guy.
My name is Murat Gabidulin. I am former Wagner Group.
Murat Gabidulin joined Wagner in 2015, about a year after Russia illegally annexed Crimea.
How did they recruit you?
That was actually me who found them. I found out about them, and they specified the address, and I went there.
We're speaking to him with the help of an interpreter. Murat fought under the Wagner banner in the Donbas region of Ukraine, one of those so-called little green men that moved into Crimea in 2014. He was also part of the Wagner force that fought ISIS in Syria. Before joining Wagner, he had a legitimate military career. He started as a Russian paratrooper back in 1993 and eventually rose to the rank of commander, and he was in charge of a Russian Air Force reconnaissance unit. But then he ran into some trouble. He said there was an administrative error that led to his separating from the military, and then shortly after he got out, he says he got tangled up with a crime boss in Moscow.
Yeah, it was a стрелял.
I ended up shooting him, and as a result, I was sentenced to prison time, and I was in prison. It was a difficult period of time for me. I was under a lot of stress. I didn't know if I would succeed anywhere else, and I thought that this would be a good place to start.
He wasn't sure if anyone would hire him after his time in prison until he started talking with a recruiter from the Wagner Group.
And to join the Wagner Group, it did not matter whether you have criminal history or not.
The recruiter was completely unfazed by his prison time. In fact, Wagner recruits heavily in his exact demographic, people with rap sheets. Probably because they know people like him are desperate for work. So they were like, yeah, prison, that's fine. We just want to know if you know how to fight. And then they sent him to a kind of boot camp to see if he really did.
I arrived to the station that they specified. It was like a military tent with the command personnel in there. So I went in, I showed my documents. They put me on the list of candidates. And then they started testing. And testing included, you know, my knowledge of the military, my physical condition, my medical condition. Then there was an interview, including the polygraph.
Were you there for hours?
2 days.
He was essentially interviewing for a job as a private soldier, which they wanted to make clear had all the downsides of being a regular one.
During the first conversation, they tell you right away that the purpose why you're there is to participate in the war, and everything can happen. You can die, you can get killed, you can become disabled. So you have to make up your mind now and decide if you want it or not.
Murat worked and fought for Wagner for 4 years. He said his last job was being a kind of aide-de-camp to Wagner's leader, Prigozhin,
and he just got sick of it.
He started appoint commanders to different units and groups, not based on their military background, but rather based on how close they were to him. Basically, they could do whatever they wanted. They were like little kings or czars.
So he left. The thing about the Wagner Group is that while it's been around for nearly a decade, until recently, it didn't officially exist. For years, Russian law prohibited the very existence of mercenaries and private military contractors. But the Russian parliament recently allowed an exception to that, so Wagner could operate more openly.
Wagner is increasingly treated openly as a tool of the Russian state.
Katrina Doxy is a researcher at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And she says people tend to see Wagner as a private military contractor, but actually, it's much more than that. They're a full-service paramilitary operation.
Commercial entities, financial intermediaries, shell companies, basically this web of different entities that is as opaque as possible by design. That's to make it more difficult to track their activities, to hold them accountable.
Since Putin gave them his seal of approval, Wagner's become more public. And the marketing blitz that Ryan in California saw has only been ramping up. There are new songs. Скучный месяц на гражданке, тёлки, бабки, суета. Я хочу разрывать танки, я хочу бомбить врага. Пусть она раздражится. Boring month in civilian life, chicks, cash, vanity, the lyrics say. I want to blow up tanks. I want to blow up the enemy. There are new videos with fast cuts of the war, a flash of tanks, explosions, guys in camo, all to the beat of the music. Wagner has also started buying ads on Pornhub, an international pornography website. Murat, the Wagner soldier who left the group in 2019, said he's seen the latest Wagner media blitz.
I watched two movies, and that was it. I mean, I couldn't watch anymore.
He couldn't watch because of the way they twist things or make events up.
So what upsets you about the movies is not emotional, something that reminds you of the fight. What upsets you is the lies?
Yes, and everything is very untrue.
The fight Wagner has put on the screen shows its soldiers as heroes, being welcomed by local crowds, which, Murat said, is not at all what he saw when he fought with them. That's part of why he got out in 2019. Since then, he settled in France and wrote a book about his experience. But since the war shows no sign of slowing down, the Wagner Group doesn't either. Their appetite for recruits is just getting more voracious.
At this point, they need to hire as many people as possible to fill their ranks. And for that reason, they're trying to hire anyone who is able to hold a gun.
Or, it turns out, anyone who can hold a keyboard. Katrina Doxy says Wagner has started advertising not just for people willing to hold a gun, but for people with technical expertise as well.
Now, hey, are you a tech guy? Are you into coding? Do you want to think about an application of those skills where you can further our mission?
Ryan, that amateur sleuth in California, says they're also starting this kind of community outreach program to lure coders into the Wagner fold. It's still on a small scale, but Ryan has seen invites to events Wagner is hosting, get-togethers with people his age. Come hang out at the Wagner Center, they say, play Counter-Strike, go on a field trip with us to a museum, or learn how to hack a drone or crack into a network. Not long ago, Ryan spotted an announcement in the Wagner Telegram channel, a hackathon, and another competition that focused on a hot technology right now.
An AI-generated art competition, you know, with different themes like Russian soldiers or something like that. And what I see is that this is a way to kind of target younger people who have the skills that they want.
Or that they'll need in the future.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Katrina Doxy says Wagner adding cyber to the portfolio makes perfect sense. It's just another tool this army for hire can offer its clients, as wars are increasingly fought not just in the battlefield, but in cyberspace too.
If indeed Wagner is trying to expand its cyber capabilities, I think it's perfectly reasonable to assume that this is in part based on just the realities of modern warfare and perhaps an expectation that Wagner will increasingly be involved in these more complex multi-domain operations.
It'll be another tool Prigozhin's army for hire can offer clients as wars move from grinding ground offensive to battles in cyberspace, too. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast about the world of cybersecurity and intelligence. This story on the Wagner mercenary group's recruiting tactics was produced by Sean Powers and Will Jarvis. You've probably heard of the idea of carbon offsets. I burn a ton of carbon and then I pay you to save a ton, keeping my carbon footprint at zero. In theory, an elegant solution. There are billions of dollars being spent on this fast-growing industry, but the problem is that integrity is low. Earlier this year, a research group found that a vast majority of rainforest offset credits, approved by the world's biggest certifier, were bogus. The industry is riddled with these scandals, but a new group is formed to try to fix it. We'll be discussing that today in our regular look at solutions to climate change, The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
For more on the problems with carbon offsets and what to do about it, we turn to William McDonnell. He's the Chief Operating Officer for the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market. It's a new nonprofit that wants to clean up the industry. He joins us from London. William, what are the main issues when it comes to the integrity of carbon offsets?
The voluntary carbon market, which is the market in which these offsets are generated and trade, that has existed for quite some time. And it has certainly funded lots of great climate action already. The trouble is that it has been unregulated. It lacks common standards. And there have been ongoing doubts about the quality of some of the credits in the market. There have been questions about greenwashing. Are some of the claims that are being made by companies buying and using the credits, are some of those claims bogus or exaggerated?
Yeah, so some serious issues. Let me just break it down. How sketchy is the carbon offset industry currently?
We're not saying that the whole market is sketchy, but I think what is true to say is that the market has a huge potential to fund much more climate action and plenty of that climate action in developing countries. And there are not very many really effective financing mechanisms at the moment. We need to save the rainforests and we need to drive transformation, and some countries are less able to fund that than others. And the market that has this potential is being held back by these doubts about quality.
Yes. So before we get to how your organization proposes a fix, let's talk about how it works currently. I mean, it does seem like it's a group of organizations that issue carbon credits to companies that are trying to offset their emissions. So briefly, explain how those organizations are currently vetted, like who monitors them?
Right. So you have organizations who run projects to issue carbon credits. And those projects could be all sorts of things, reducing deforestation in rainforests, or there are technology-based projects like capturing methane from agricultural processes, issuing clean cook stoves in developing countries. Organizations develop these projects. They then apply to a certification body to have those projects certified and then to issue credits. There's independent third parties who verify the actual calculations and the performance of, you know, how is the project doing what it said it would do. What we would then do is bring some standardization across the different organizations and methodologies and approaches that are being done.
What would be the motivation for a company to follow your standardization? And how do you propose that standardization? Is it the stamp of approval?
Many companies want to buy credits. They've allocated budgets. It's part of their low carbon strategy. But in order to be confident in the credits they buy, they would like an independent, as you say, stamp of approval. And at the moment, you've got competing organizations with different methodologies and approaches, and it's difficult to tell how they compare. We've developed the principles and we've nearly finished developing the detailed framework of criteria. That means that we can then issue our stamp of approval to sets of carbon credits, and the buyers will be able to easily identify that. That will give them confidence and encourage the market to grow further and fulfill its potential.
William, over the weekend, UN climate chief Simon Steele spoke against the idea of carbon removal. He said climate goals can only be met through the, quote, significantly reduced use of all fossil fuels. How do you respond to those who say offsets are a distraction from the urgency of drastic decarbonization?
I say that it's absolutely right that drastic decarbonization is the most pressing, urgent thing we have to do. The use of offsets does not and cannot replace urgently tackling emissions. So if you're a company, it's not that you can say, oh, well, I'm buying offsets, therefore I don't need to push so hard to reduce my own emissions. What you are strongly encouraged to do is to have ambitious decarbonization plans for your business and your supply chain and deliver on those, but also to buy credits to compensate for the emissions that you still have until those are reduced as far as you can. It's not a get out of jail free card.
William McDonald is Chief Operating Officer for the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market, a new nonprofit that wants to clean up problems in the carbon offset market. William, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco. My pleasure.
One more item before we go today. The subject has shown up in TV and in films.
By the end of 1957, 3 out of 4 babies born were coming from fatherless impregnation.
Parthenogenesis, a baby without a daddy.
Parthenogenesis, you'll remember, also showed up in Jurassic Park.
You're implying that a group composed entirely of female animals will breed?
No, I'm simply saying that life finds a way.
And it did in a mysterious virgin birth in Costa Rica. A female crocodile who'd been living alone in a zoo for 16 years laid a clutch of 14 eggs. One of them contained a baby crocodile.
In this case, that embryo had developed to a fully formed animal that, if it had have lived, should have been fine.
Warren Booth is an expert on parthenogenesis.
We sequenced the genome of the mother, and we sequenced the genome of the putative parthenogen.
The parthenogen, that's the baby crocodile, which was stillborn. She contained the same DNA as her mother. And what's more important is what Booth and his team did not find.
We did not find any evidence of paternal DNA.
No evidence of a father. Booth is an evolutionary biologist at Virginia Tech. He says this is the first known case of parthenogenesis in crocodiles, but it has been well documented in other creatures.
And what we see is that the birds, the crocodiles, and even the group prior to that, being the reptiles, the snakes and the lizards, they all use the same parthenogenetic mechanism.
And because crocodiles are even earlier in the evolutionary path, it indicates that ancient ancestors like dinosaurs may have been able to reproduce this way. But he says there's no way to prove it.
Sadly not. You know, we can't extract DNA from fossils.
But he can ask important questions like, how does parthenogenesis get passed along?
I believe it's a single gene that when a female inherits it from her mother and her father, will increase the likelihood of that female being able to produce parthenogenetically.
Warren Booth of Virginia Tech asking some big questions. That's what we do each day here at The World from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.